Yes, people, welcome back to another episode of the What's Going On podcast. I'm Chua, and I'm joined here today by Matt Slater, senior football news reporter at The Athletic. And we're here to speak about the Premier League and how it became the giant it is today. Thanks for joining us, Matt. Absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Oh, happy to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me.
First things first, how are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. And I know when we spoke, you told me you just got back from FIFA Congress in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. How was that?
It was good in terms of the place. I'd never been, so I found it. I was only there for 2-3 days. I thought it was a fascinating place. You know, lively, vibrant, colourful. I thought the people were very friendly. It's a bustling place. On that first journey from the airport to the hotel, just seeing everybody on motorbikes and bikes. The easiest way to get around is to jump on the back of a motorbike, kind of a motorbike taxi, which looks a little bit, I didn't fancy that, to be honest.
What are they called? Are they called Buddha Buddhas?
Yeah, I think something like that. Right. Yeah, I think something like that.
So it might be the same.
Well, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. Yeah. And they are, because the traffic is so bad, you need to weave between the cars. But they are weaving between the cars, and just how close everyone was getting to each other. I just thought it was incredible to watch. Yeah. I felt much safer in my taxi. I thought it was great. And then just from the event, FIFA congresses, and all these big sporting body congresses, they're not for everybody. There's a lot of procedure, agendas, schedules, a lot of kind of politics. They can be very dry affairs. They're certainly a long, long way away from the sport, if you like. But important stuff happens at them, and that is the point. This is where the decisions are made about, we're talking about FIFA. So the next World Cup, the format for the next World Cup, getting that sorted out, the divide of money for the Women's World Cup, the president, Gianni Infantino, who of course drives so many of the big decisions in global football, was elected for another 4-year term. That was a little bit controversial. There was no challenger, so unopposed. He's claiming it's his second term. Some people would say it's his third term. So you have a whole issue about how long one man should be in charge of something and if that's a good thing, just in terms of democracy. There were a little bit of, there's some debate around Qatar and the legacy of Qatar and what FIFA, what the sport learned from that whole experience. There was plenty, I'm forgetting. Club World Cup. So that, of course, is one of FIFA's great new projects, expanding what is the relatively small 7-team annual competition into a genuine World Cup of clubs. So 4 years in a summer, 32 teams. So we got a lot more detail on that.
They're really expanding that.
Hugely. And just how much money FIFA's earning. That was all explained.
Do you remember how much expanded. It is?
So they do everything on a 4-year cycle, all based around a men's World Cup. And just rule of thumb, generally speaking, FIFA basically makes a loss in every year apart from a World Cup year. And so you have 3 years of famine and 1 year of feast.
I didn't know
that's when all the broadcast and commercial contracts are done around this 4-year cycle. It's the same in the Olympics. And the most recent cycle that's just finished, the Qatar cycle, was a very successful one. About $7 billion, perhaps a little tad. I know it's about that, wasn't it? And that also encompasses the pandemic as well. So it was above predictions, and of course that means FIFA was able to share, because it keeps pointing out it's sort of a not-for-profit organization that shares all the money. So every member association, and there are 211 of them, more than the United Nations, again, that's one of FIFA's great claims to fame, gets more money. And it's one member, one vote, and every member gets the same amount of money. So generally speaking, 7 years ago when Infantino took over, followed Sepp Blatter, each member association got about $250,000 a year. They're now getting about $2 million a year. And in the next cycle, so the cycle for the 2026 World Cup, which of course is this 48-team World Cup, it's going to be over 5.5 weeks, 104 games. It's in US, Canada, and Mexico. It's going to be massive. They are expecting to make, I think, about $12 billion US dollars. And that could even be more, because that doesn't even include the Club World Cup, which they want to start in 2025. So it's a doubling. The whole point is it's almost a doubling of what they made over the last 4 years, which means every member association will expect for their grants to be doubled. So yeah, FIFA is doing pretty well.
What do you think are the main factors into why the revenues have doubled or expected to double?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I think a lot of it is to just do with the burgeoning popularity of football. Football is the world's favorite game. It is continuing to grow, and it is the world's favorite sport, despite the fact that it is not the number one sport in three of the largest markets in the world. So North America, US, basically, right, China, and India. In each of those countries, football is a long way behind other sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
So there is there is huge growth potential in these massive markets. And, you know, you have the story of, you know, Africa, Asia, other parts of the world. You know, they're growing too. The sport is getting ever more professionalized, if you like. The World Cups are growing. The women's game is growing. It's a story of growth. And football, for whatever reason, is just that intersection of media, entertainment, you know, live entertainment.
Right. It is
one of the stories of our time. You know, as technology has rapidly developed to enable people to watch what they want, when they want, football's rights have become more valuable. You know, sport is unscripted drama. It is relatively cheap compared to films and Game of Thrones, etc. You don't time shift it, so it's very valuable to advertisers. You have to watch it in the moment. The cool sport of the era, and that has changed over you know 100 years or so, is always going to be valuable. It's always going to be a valuable product. And football is just, I suppose, fortunate that it's come along, that its moment, its period of dominance has come along at a time when the world is able to watch and consume live entertainment in so many different ways. You know, phones, we're chatting on our laptop here. So yeah, this is football's moment, and it's cashing in. It's doing well.
Fascinating. Before we dive into the Premier League, if you could quickly just tell us a little bit about your role at The Athletic.
So I'm a sort of news guy. So I don't, well, unlike a lot of my colleagues who follow specific clubs, they're beat reporters for clubs. That was very much our MO, if you like, you know, that we were going to, that was what we're going to do. I cover the bits in between, right? So I cover business and I cover politics, rows. I do lots of rows and disputes, yeah, but also kind of explainers of complicated bits. You know, it could be an accountancy type story, a sports politics story, a doping story, a financial story, because there's a big club that's been taken over. So it can be all sorts of things, to be honest. Right. And I've been doing this intersection, if you like, between sport and news for a while now. I've been doing it for sort of 10, 15 years before I came to The Athletic as well. So it's what I enjoy. I never really know what my next story will be. You know, I have some areas of expertise, I suppose. But I'm very much a generalist. You know, I keep telling people I'm not an expert at anything. I certainly enjoy business, politics, that kind of thing. And all through the prism of sport, right? It's all got to be relevant to sport.
I really enjoy your work. I mean, when you told me you were open to being on this podcast, I was absolutely buzzing. So I'll definitely share a link to, you know, all your work and so on in the description for the episode so everyone can read. But yeah, let's go into the Premier League.
Okay.
The Premier League was founded in 92. I want to get your thoughts on why was the Premier League founded in the first place?
Well, it's about money. Much of what I do is about money. I don't want to bore your listeners too much. It came about because the biggest clubs in England got fed up with sharing with the rest. And it took a long time to get to that point. I won't tell the whole story. There was sort of long running disputes between the Football League, which we now call the English Football League, which used to be the top four divisions, the 92, we talk about 92, and the Football Association. They are the governing body in England. They run the national team, they run grassroots football, they run the non-league scene. They are, if you like, the overriding power. But they had this long-running dispute with leagues, with clubs. And that played into the creation of the Premier League as well. The FA was forever looking at ways of weakening club football. And this breakaway league formed. The impetus for it grew during the 80s. As what I was saying in my previous answer, as more and more of us started to watch football, wanting to watch football on television, and there was, again, very conveniently, this was around the time that satellite TV, pay TV, was really taking off in this country. And the people that were backing those channels realized, how can we get people to subscribe? Well, it's sort of movies, big TV shows, not so much at the time then, and football. Mm. So football became this battering ram to convince Brits who had previously had a TV license and had the BBC and maybe one or two other advertising funded channels. No, I need to pay. I will happily pay for TV. I will have a Sky dish or, on top of my house, and I will watch premium television, premium entertainment. Mm. And my premium entertainment is going to be this new football competition of just the best teams,
right?
Detached from the others, from the other 72. So the top 20 form this breakaway league, and they basically, it's like a gated community. They ring fence the money. So instead of sharing it the formulas kind of changed a lot during the 80s as the English Football League tried to keep everyone together. But broadly speaking, it was kind of the biggest clubs, the top division got about 50% of the money. The second division got about 25% of the money. And divisions 3 and 4 shared the rest. It was a 50, 25, 12.5 model.
Okay.
It did shift. There were some changes. So I am speaking generally. The Premier League, no, we're not going to take 50%. We're going to take, this is where the arguments start. They take about 85% now. If you look at the entire pot, so that's quite a big increase. And look, by breaking away and running the league themselves, so the 20 clubs, the 20 clubs that are in it, they are shareholders in it. The FA remains as the sort of governing body, but FA has basically lost power over the last 30 years. The Premier League runs the show. The 20 biggest clubs run the show in English football these days. It enabled them to, they all had a stake in the business, but perhaps in a way they didn't feel they had a stake in the bigger business before, the 92. It was more concentrated.
Right.
So they had a very close relationship with their broadcasters, with Sky. That was the key relationship, that kind of new pay TV beast that emerged in the late 80s, early 90s. And they drove quality. They really did. It was always this idea, this is a premium entertainment product. So everything's got to look good. Stadiums have got to look good. There were various things happening in the 80s. Hooliganism was an issue. There were some disasters, some fan disasters, Hillsborough, Heysel, that kind of led to disgust, outcry. Something must be done. So stadiums had to improve. Government put some money into that. football became a sort of popular again. The England team in 1990 did well in Italy. It was a sort of sense that football was on the up, that the middle classes were interested in football again. So the Premier League tapped into all of that, you know, the new technology, the new TV product, greater money, keeping more of the money, investing it in the product, the stadiums getting better, the demographics of the crowd were getting better. Hooliganism was being left behind. More people, different people coming to stadiums. You could raise ticket prices. We're going to all-seater stadiums. You could raise ticket prices. You could keep them there longer. You could sell them more stuff. And as more money went into the product, i.e. players, better players, more overseas players, you created this virtuous circle. And that has been the story of the Premier League.
And now that you talk about it, like, I definitely see some parallels with the Super League that was proposed in, I guess it was April 2021. You know, about them wanting to keep the money, you know, keep the honeypot for themselves. And I guess that's also led to the, as you said, like the wide disparities, the wide financial gap between the Championship and the Premier League, right? With the Championship playoff game being the most lucrative game in world football, clubs losing, I don't know, 60 million overnight by being relegated and so on. Do you think that's a problem? Like, do you think more has to be done to filter down money from the Premier League to, you know, to the other leagues?
Yeah, I think it's a massive problem. And it's one we've been debating passionately here for years, but very kind of that debate has ramped up in the last couple of years for a few reasons. I mean, you know, one would be the pandemic was a massive shock to the football industry, and lots of clubs in the EFL and even further down the pyramid, because that's one of the unique things about English football. No other country has a pyramid as deep. You can definitely have debates about quality. I'm not going to get involved in which is the better football or anything like that. But what I will tell you, and I think that there is no real dispute about this, no one plays football professionally as deeply, as far down, as and goes to watch it and pays to
That's
watch
true.
It as England. England and Scotland. It's something,
and no question.
It is our USB. It's our secret sauce. So,
For sure. Even the salaries people get.
There are good things and bad things about that. Don't get me wrong. But that is the unique bit. I guess you could say, well, look, you know, in US sport, you have college football, college basketball, you have minor league baseball teams. Right, fine. There is a similarity, but it's not quite the same, because English football is based on a pyramid with promotion and relegation, with a flow from top to bottom, you know, with genuine connections. You can move up, you can move down. That is the difference. So I think that for me is worth protecting. And that is why we have these, I would say, almost endless debates really about what's a fair distribution, how much money should flow down the pyramid, how much money should be shared. So we had that, if you like, shock to the system in 1992. When the 20 clubs decided they didn't want to share so much. We've had 30 years of debate around, well, okay, can we get them to do a little bit more? Can we get them to do targeted subsidies for grassroots infrastructure, for women's football? Can we get them to do a targeted one-off intervention to help the EFL clubs through the pandemic? To, I would say, today's debate, which came, as I said, off the back of the shocks of the pandemic, where a couple of EFL clubs actually went bankrupt or went, you know, disappeared. And we hadn't had that for a while. Then you had the additional shock of, oh, another breakaway. So they're not happy with the 92 breakaway. The Big Six now want to join this other little gang with their peers on the continent.
Yeah.
And do the drawbridge again. That caused the massive shocks to the system. So those shocks, those sort of twin crises, created a catalyst for change. Something's got to happen. So a former sports minister called Tracy Crouch was asked to do a review. It was called a fan-led review because it involved consulting fans into the governance of football. That then became, it's taken a while. I'm racing through the steps here a little bit. There was opposition to that from the clubs, you know, the status quo. And we've got to a point where the government has finally backed her recommendations that English football needs an independent regulator because it can't be trusted to sort out these huge issues themselves. They just argue and they go around in circles and self-interest rules everything. So an independent regulator is going to come along at some point. We're still arguing about that now.
Yeah, that was announced like a month ago or something.
Yeah, right? Well, yeah, exactly. And we're in a sort of short consultation period. They were talking about it yesterday in Parliament. And this regulator is going to do ... right? We shall see. But in theory, we'll have the power to force the Premier League to share a bit more money.
Okay.
Now, it would like the Premier League and the English Football League and the FA to get there themselves to agree on a fairer distribution. And that is kind of what we're observing right now. The government does not really want to intervene and does not want its independent regulator to have to be policing this stuff all the time. But
interesting.
The threat is there.
And on the point of independent regulator, another area that they'll be focused on, isn't that also like ownership when it comes to clubs, making sure owners have the best interests of clubs at heart, the right finances in place, and also understanding where that money comes from, right? Like, so it's not only about the trickling down the system, but also ownership, right?
Yeah. Oh, there's various things it will do, but you're right. That is one of the other sort of big bones of contention, one of the big controversial topics here. So we talk about an owners and directors test. So there is this, like I said, English football goes a long way down. Lots of clubs, the fifth tier of English football, what we used to call non-league, the first division of that is now professional. There are something like 116 professional clubs in England alone. So they get bought and sold. Football as an industry is very keen that owners are good, right? That they have, they're allowed to own companies. They know what they're doing. They're competent. They're not laundering money. They are not asset stripping. They're not into football just to shut the business down, knock the stadium down and build houses. These are the things that football fans worry about because they have
sports watching as well
in the past. Yeah, all of that. I mean, that's a sort of, I would say, a newer and more controversial area. And what can anyone do about that legally? It's a tricky area. So football has to operate within the laws of the land. The UK is traditionally quite laissez-faire, quite liberal in terms of who it allows to buy and sell clubs and companies, and who it allows to operate here. We've always been open to investment, perhaps more open than some other European countries. That's certainly, part of the sort of the British story. Now, whether it's true or not is debatable, but that's certainly a sort of story we tell ourselves. So football has to operate within that framework. And the method that football has is this thing called an owners and directors test, which is very much a objective test. You know, are you a bad guy? And, are you allowed to own a company or run a company? Have you got a conviction for fraud or money laundering? Have you ever defrauded a football club? Are you engaged in sort of illegal betting activity? That kind of thing. And as long as you don't tick any of these boxes, you're allowed to buy a club. The thing that has perhaps changed in recent years, because the test has got harder for the better, most fans would say, is they are increasingly asking potential owners, well, can you actually afford it? Can you show us that you can run Club X for a couple of years? Because this is how much it costs. This is what their budget is. Do you have 2 years worth of money? And I think that's a good system, and it is certainly, I think, kept out some potentially bad owners. There's still some bad owners in the system, and you'll still make mistakes. You don't catch everybody, and look, good owners can make mistakes, and businesses fail, right? But this owners and directors test has got better. The idea is that that at the moment the leagues themselves operate it, and perhaps they're not best placed. Perhaps certainly the EFL doesn't have the know-how, the expertise, the money, the resources to do forensic checks of people. And if you give it away to a third party, this independent regulator, they do it better. They do it quicker, more efficiently, more consistently. and that would be a better outcome.
Yeah, fascinating. Let's take it a step back. It's tough to argue that the Premier League has become the most lucrative and competitive football league in the world. But what do you think are the key factors contributing to its success?
Well, I mean, again, it's a good question. So in no particular order, if I go back to my answer about right at the beginning, there was a real focus on quality, this idea this is going to be premium entertainment. So and being very having a close relationship with the broadcaster. So again, that's a very American idea. You know, they really talk about broadcast partners and putting on a good show. What do you need? So you need access to players, you need good studio space, you need enough light bulbs in the state in the lights so that it looks good, right?
You need
for sure. What do you need to make a good TV show?
Yeah, that's something I've noticed. Like when I watch Serie A compared to the Premier League just looks so much better on TV.
Consistency.
Sharper
it's all picture. It's all in the handbook. And it's the handbook is hundreds of pages long. So when promoted clubs go up, you know, they all have to make sure that they comply and they get taken to meetings and they're helped. So that I think was part of it. There's some other bits, you know, some good luck. So the time, you know, kind of timing was right. I mentioned the fact that football was sort of its popularity was growing in this country after a pretty bad period in the 70s and 80s, you know, declining popularity. So you can see football's popularity in this country kind of go up and down, right? So it was massive 1900s, 10s, 20s, 30s, World War II comes along, even the 40s and 50s, the crowds were massive. But then other sports come along, other things happen. Fashions change, and there was a sort of period of decline 50s, 60s, 70s. Hooliganism didn't help. English football wasn't great in the 70s, 80s, and then it bottoms out and it's been growing ever since again. So there was that. The English language, I think, helps. So,
yeah, definitely.
The power of the English language, the fact that it's so widely spoken around the world, the time zone helps again. That's almost connected to that old historical advantages. So Greenwich Mean Time zero runs through London, so it's quite well situated for an audience in Asia. It's not too late for them, it's not too early for North America, and then I think just by embracing foreign players, foreign investors, foreign investment, it opened markets, opened audiences abroad. They had a stake in our league. The league very quickly became a bit like Wimbledon, right? So they often talk about the Wimbledon effect. So Wimbledon is a famous tennis tournament in London that for most of my life, English tennis players have been periphery to it. You know, they're all out after about 3 or 4 days. You know, okay, Andy Murray has sort of changed things, but he's Scottish. But anyway, you know, you take my point. The fact is that Wimbledon was the venue. Wimbledon was the stage, the setting for this international sports event. Right. The Premier League is a bit like that. You know, people might push back and say, well, hold on, English players are still important. And they are. You know, the number of English players fell dramatically. The proportion of English players fell dramatically in those first 10, 15 years. But they've actually stabilized in the last 10, 15, at about a third. There's a debate when that goes up or down, but it's about a third, so one in three. And that appears to be about right. You know, the English national team's doing better than it was 20 years ago. And there's, you know, the English academies are producing decent players. They're actually starting to play abroad more than they used to as well.
Yeah, like Bellingham and...
Yeah, exactly. So I think by being... By a real focus on the quality, a real focus on the TV product, but also the match day product. So, again, compared to some of its European rivals, and this goes back to my answer about the 80s and 90s, certainly the 70s and 80s being quite dark and these disasters. So there's a big spend on infrastructure. The stadiums got better. So our stadiums are full. The TV product's good. It's very international. So that brings global sponsors.
Yeah, like and having someone like Heung-Min Son from Korea, suddenly all Korea watches, Ji-Sung Park, tons of examples like that.
Exactly. So, and then you get this virtuous cycle effect, right? Mm-hmm. So no other league, even the NFL, gets close to the Premier League in terms of its international broadcast rights. No other league is going around the world, and like it does in Scandinavia, for example, and gets more money than the Scandinavian domestic leagues get.
Mm.
That's ridiculous. The NFL or the NBA would love that to be the case.
Yeah.
So that is why the Premier League, its advantage, its gap over the English Football League, but also La Liga, Bundesliga, Serie A, Ligue 1, has grown. It's this international appeal, which back in 1992, they didn't really predict.
Mm.
A lot of this was wasn't predicted. So that's that. There are lots of reasons for the success, but the success has begat more success. It is a
virtuous cycle.
Exactly.
It's impossible not to talk about broadcasting revenues. As you mentioned, you know, the amount of money Premier League gets from international broadcasting. I think it's the only league in the world which gets more from international broadcasting than domestic broadcasting.
Correct. Yeah.
And it also distributes money more evenly than other leagues. Like I think in Spain, Barcelona, Real Madrid, and Atletico take about a third of the whole pot, right? But in Premier League, it's very evenly distributed. Of course, there's a little bit of merit as well, how well you do in the league.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is pretty evenly distributed. Yeah, what are your thoughts on this? And why do you think other leagues don't, you know, distribute it in the same way as well?
Well, again, if you speak to the Premier League people, they will tell you this is one of the key reasons. So in my last answer, they would have said, oh, you've forgotten something. And it's to do with the meritocracy, this idea that the Premier League is very competitive. And there are lots of different ways of looking at this. Broadly speaking, they're right. It's the same. It tends to be the same clubs winning. But we have a big six, probably a big seven now, which is considerably more than the other leagues have.
Germany and France.
Yeah. And there's certainly a lot of... It might be that Man City or Liverpool are winning a lot at the moment. Or before it was Man United, or even go back into history, it was Liverpool. You have these spells of domination. There's certainly a lot of competition for European places. There's certainly a lot of competition, you know, for that sort of third, fourth, fifth, sixth. And there's a lot of competition at the bottom of the division as well.
Mm. Yeah, especially this season.
Now, some of it is a bit of a myth, but it's a powerful myth. It's a compelling myth. And the Premier League would say that it's set out to do this by what they would call a very narrow merit rake. So whatever the best team is earning, the bottom team earns a good fixed percentage of that. And the gap between top and bottom isn't very wide. So broadly speaking, until quite recently, the team that comes first earns 1.6 times as much as the team that finishes bottom. So, right, to make it simple, if the bottom team's earning 100 million, the top team gets 160 million of a central handout. Now, that's actually increased a little bit to more like 1 to 1.8 because of a complicated thing to do with the international rights. Again, which was something that people didn't see coming. They didn't realise that the Premier League would ever earn so much money internationally. And they were sharing that money out literally equally, evenly, 1/20th. And the big clubs pointed out, well, hold on a minute. We share out the domestic rights on this sort of merit-based system. Shouldn't we do the same for international rights as well? I.e., we want more money because they felt they were driving these international sales, which
is true.
It's broadly true. So we've gone to it's grown slightly, 1 to 1.8. Still, by far, the narrowest from top to bottom distribution in Europe. Now, what's interesting is many of the other leagues, and Spain's probably the best example of this, have looked at this, and they have narrowed their distributions. I think Spain's at, might be 1 to 2.8 now, 1 to 3-ish. It was a ridiculous rate because they let Barca and Real do their own TV deals. They didn't even sell the TV deals centrally. That's, again, a crucial part of the Premier League story. We're going to sell everything centrally. We're going to distribute it centrally. You know, kind of an NFL North American way of doing it. Portugal, I think, is the last country to actually... Nearly every other league in Europe has cottoned onto that and has copied that model.
Okay.
Portugal, I think, is the last to do it, and will be doing it in the next season, I think. They were letting their big clubs sell their own TV rights. So pretty much everyone now is doing central selling of TV rights, and pretty much every league has narrowed the distribution. But none has gone as far as the Premier League. Now, the Premier League would say that is why our league is more competitive. Now, how do you define competitive? But it certainly enables the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and so on, best teams in the Premier League to spend quite a lot of money on players. And that has been the story of the last year, the last two transfer windows, where they have been outspending the biggest clubs in Italy and Spain and France and Germany. It's that guaranteed money that they are given. And the Premier League would say, we give it to them because we are constantly trying to improve the product. We don't want a sort of Scotland type situation or a Spain type situation where we all just wait for the El Clasico. We all wait for the Old Firm Derby. We all wait for Borussia Dortmund versus Bayern Munich. No, we want event matches every weekend. You know, we want Brentford, a really good Brentford, to take points off the big six. We want Brighton. We love those stories. We want Crystal Palace. We want Aston Villa. We want Leeds United. We want all these other clubs to have budgets and certainty of budget to enable them to go out and buy good players. So they can give Liverpool, Man United, Man City, Chelsea, Arsenal good games and occasionally beat them.
Yeah.
That is the point. Now can La Liga really say the same? I mean, I don't think they can. I think Javier Tebas would like to be able to say the same, but I don't think he can.
Don't think so either. You also see the likes of, I think, in January, Bournemouth. I think they spent more money than the whole of the La Liga combined. And you have players like, you know, going from Atletico Madrid to Nottingham Forest, right? Like Champions League clubs to you know, bottom of the Premier League. So it is a pretty fascinating development.
Indeed. Yeah. And it's been noted around Europe. Is the Premier League the new European Super League? It's a good debate. Well, I mean, no, not literally, because it's not. But I understand the point they're making. Is there a Super League in Europe? And if there is, it's probably the Premier League. What can anyone do about that? I think is an interesting subject topic. Is it too late? I don't think it's too late. Nothing's too late. Nothing lasts forever. It's got a big advantage, and that advantage appears to be stretching at the moment.
True that.
So what does the rest of Europe do about it? Do they try and be like the Premier League? Is it too late for the Bundesliga? Is it too late for La Liga? I think that's interesting. Does it lean more heavily on Champions League money? So that, I think, is interesting. Mm. That's one of the reasons, one of the factors that in many ways has enabled those big clubs, Real, Barca, Bayern, PSG, the Italian clubs, the Italian Giants. It's why it hasn't been so noticeable until now. It's why the Premier League clubs don't win in Europe every year. It's because those big clubs have, one, they've skewed their own domestic competitions.
Yeah, heavily.
But two, because of that, they also get this additional revenue from Europe. And the additional revenue from Europe has enabled them to keep pace with England's biggest clubs. So I think that just will continue. You know, the Champions League is growing again, and that a lot of that comes from pressure from those clubs.
Yeah, they're expanding it.
To generate more money to keep up with the Premier League. And that's why the European Super League as an idea will never really die. It keeps coming up. It keeps putting pressure on UEFA to innovate, to grow, to concede to their demands. So there's that. Does the Super League come back in another format? Is it a continental league without the English clubs? That's interesting. Do we get cross-border leagues? Do you, to compete with the Premier League, just grow your market? So could we have, I don't know, an Iberian league, a Spanish-Portugal league? Could we have a...
Has that been discussed?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, these things are constantly discussed. You know, it's at what level they're discussed. Do we get a Benelux league? I mean, okay, that I don't think would create a market big enough to compete with the Premier League, but it would certainly maybe create a market big enough to compete with the French league, maybe even the Italian league. So there are ways you could do it. There are ways you could address it. Is someone going to be really brave and rip up the broadcast rights model and go direct to consumer, go streaming?
What are your thoughts on that, actually?
Well, I mean, I think these are all fascinating ideas. Yeah. I think the problem, if you are not a Premier League club or a Premier League executive, is the Premier League are thinking about these things as well. It's a moving target. The Premier League is not going to stand still on innovation. And is party to all these conversations as well. So it is one of, I think, the big talking points of European football at the moment, the Premier League's dominance. And we are coming off the back of these two windows where their spending power has just blown people away. I think it's actually quite embarrassing even to the Premier League. You know, I think they would prefer it if it wasn't so obvious, because it brings attention on them.
And a lot of resentment as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think I would, the caveat I'd throw in there is that some of this has been exaggerated by the pandemic. So the Premier League, for some structural reasons, for some good decisions they made, for that TV rights money, that international TV rights money, that security they had, emerged from the pandemic stronger than the other leagues. It hurt all of them, including the Premier League. It just hurt the Premier League less. So what we are witnessing now is almost it's kind of like kind of game theory. The Premier League are doubling down on their advantage. They are speculating. You know, they're doing a lot of this with debt. You know, they're borrowing money from their owners. But they have a competitive advantage now that they are hammering home. And then I think there's another element that they would all, just to throw in, just to confuse your listeners a bit. some of it is a response to a weakness. So the UK leaving the EU, Brexit, has made things a little bit harder for Premier League clubs, and they no longer have access
like work permits and so on.
Work permits, but really importantly, 16, 17-year-old EU talent. So they feel they are having to buy people a little bit later when they're a bit more developed and a bit more expensive. And because they're all competing with each other for the same players, they think that has driven up prices. So, look, I have some sympathy with that. But equally, I think we should factor in that the Premier League clubs, I think, are choosing right now to put the foot on the accelerator because they can see the rest of Europe is weak. They can see that Barca's going through a bad period.
Yeah.
Real have been, you know, concentrating on building the stadium. The other French clubs are sort of struggling to cope. They had a problem with their TV deal. They struggled through the pandemic. Italy, Serie A, has some real structural problems around their TV deal, the state of their stadiums. So I think Premier League clubs are seizing the moment.
So you don't think Premier League should take any responsibility for making sure that, you know, the rest of Europe can keep up, right? Like, they should just double down and maximize their own growth, right?
Well, we've been talking about their view on whether they should be charitable to teams in their own pyramid. we talked about how the Premier League was formed in 1992 and how we're still arguing today about whether they should send more money down the pipe to clubs in the Championship and League One and League Two. So I think there's your answer. Self-interest. And where does charity start? I don't hear anybody in English football say, do you know what? What about Italy and those poor clubs in La Liga?
That's not. Well, why should they care?
Yeah.
One point you touched on, which I thought was really interesting, was going direct to consumer, streaming, and so on. I live in Scandinavia. I'm able to watch all the Premier League games from the same service. And I've heard about people in the UK, seen a lot of people complain about it. You know, they pay for Sky, they pay for BT. And then there's, you know, of course, coupled with the 3 p.m. blackout rule. So they pay all the money and they're still a lot of the time not even able to watch their own team play. Do you think it's a problem that international fans are able to watch the Premier League a lot more easily than local fans? And do you think something has to be done in the UK?
I think it's inevitable. So, and it's inevitable for a really simple reason, and that's that my like 9-year-old knows how to watch games. They can find them. You know, modern technology. It's the 3 p.m. blackout rule is a very controversial issue here, and I can see both sides. It is really to safeguard the live audience of clubs further down the pyramid. And if you support a non-Premier League club, you perhaps understand and feel it more than if you don't support a non-Premier League club. And again, that goes back to my answer about what is special about English football. Well, it is that we have so many clubs. It is that so many of us go to watch games in the fifth tier, sixth tier, seventh tier. And should we protect that? people here would say, well, we should protect it, but you know, how do we protect it? You know, is that particular measure, does it work anymore? And I think that's the debate. You talked about streaming. Pretty much everyone under the age of 40 can find a game. Right now, from an industry point of view, that's crazy, because you are basically incentivizing piracy. That money is just leaking out of the game. That is wasted money. It's uncollected money. There is an audience that wants to watch this stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure they pay for like monthly streaming.
Well, yeah, you know, some people won't, right? Because some people are naughty. That's just life. Yeah. Okay. But I think there are a great many people that would prefer the better quality and not breaking the law. Most people, if it's a reasonable amount of money for a decent product, i.e. it doesn't keep buffering and you're not bombarded with stupid adverts, and you don't feel you're doing anything wrong, most people would pay for that. So that, I think, is where we're heading to. And I think the piracy issue and the fact that broadcasters who are paying huge money for this are saying, well, look, one, you either do something about piracy, you either help us fight piracy, or we have a conversation about the fact that life has changed. And I think we're in that moment now. So that it's a live topic. I'm not quite sure if anyone's quite ready to jump like full on into OTT and direct to consumer and Netflix and football, all those ideas. But it's happening. It's going to happen over the next few years.
Final question. What challenges do you see for the Premier League over the coming years?
Well, we've discussed, I suppose, a few of them. One, there's this national debate about sharing the money and the regulator. And so that's playing out now. So that's something they've got to be mindful of, getting that right. You know, they've been opposed to that, but look, they've been dragged along by politicians, right, and by sort of momentum, really. So that's I suppose is a challenge to them. I think they'll be okay. I think they'll manage that challenge. You yourself said there's, you know, resentment abroad. I think that's another challenge. You know, how it manages that. Doesn't want to be a bully. It doesn't want to kill or be accused of killing football, killing domestic leagues around the world. There would, if that was genuinely starting to happen in an obvious way, if, you know, the Premier League was somehow to blame for MLS failing or Indian football never really taking off, or I think there'll be a pushback, and I think there could be a problem there. The things that, you know, chief executives of companies should always worry about: what next? You know, we're doing well now, but my job is to think about problems, right? There's that, but also what are the things that I haven't seen coming? You know, what could hit us? The pandemic was something that came out of the blue. Are we ready for the next one of those? Are we ready for a massive change in audience habits? So, you know, I've referenced my kids. You know, my kids don't watch 90-minute games. They just watch clips. They play FIFA. They then watch stuff on YouTube. You know, they would rather sometimes watch the game. I'm watching it on TV, but they're sat next to me on their phones, and they'll look up to see a goal, but then they'll want to see it again. They'll want to talk about it with their mate. It's just a completely different way of viewing sport.
Yeah.
Likewise, the live event, right? So the ticket prices, everyone knows, in most countries are going up. The age, the demographic of fans in the stadium then goes up. Is that a problem? You know, do we risk losing the next generation of football fans? How do we create that habit of going to games, of going to live entertainment? Do we risk losing the passion? So there are so many potential issues that even sports or leagues within sports who are on top should always be thinking.
For sure.
Right. Well, what are the kids actually playing? What are they looking at? Okay. What are our rivals doing? Are they? What happens if they go quicker into direct to consumer and streaming than we do? And then, you know, our advantage could evaporate in 10 years because we're there too. So these are the things. So I think there's a range of potential issues. They're in a good place though, and my dealings with them, they're pretty smart. They're pretty aware of risks. But yeah, like I don't sense complacency about their position. I just think that they've had a good 20 years.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Thanks so much, Matt. Learned a lot from you. Really enjoyed having you on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. I'll happily talk about this stuff.
All right, Matt. Have a good day.
And you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.